This is the Feminine Podcast, the official podcast of Feminine, discussing all things femme, a little bit of EM, and everything in between. I'm Jenny Beck-Esme, Editor-in-Chief of Feminine. Now, first up, I just want to get to one quick announcement, and that is that I want all the medical students out there to check out the Fix 18 Student Ambassador Program. This is going to allow students to come to Fix 18 and help us with all the logistics, learn a little bit about conference organization, planning, and do some fantastic networking. So check out the website for all the details, but just plug it in the back of your brain that the application, which is really pretty simple, is due April 23rd. So go to feminem.com, look in the Fix 18 area, and check out that application process. Next up, let's get to our next Fix 17 talk. So this is from Dr. Jeanette Wolf, and she's an associate professor of emergency medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, Bay State. She's also the creator of a website and blog that explores how biological sex and gender influence our brain, body, and behavior. It's called sexandwhy.com, and you should check it out. In her Fix 17 talk, she explores how women can often bring each other down in the workplace, how we're not always each other's best friends or biggest support systems in the workplace, and why that happens, and kind of explore some ways we can work together to get past this behavior. It's a really fantastic talk, so take a listen and then go check out Dr. Wolf's website and podcast.
So what is up with this? Why is it so hard to work with other women? So this is who I am. I have a few disclosures, which is really coffee latte money, if that. I'm an editor and writer for EPM. Essentially, I read a lot, write a lot, lecture about it, and if I'm lucky, do a little consulting. My passion is talking about how biological sex and gender impact our brain, our neuroscience, our body, our pathophysiology, and our behavior. So inevitably, because I'm talking about sex and gender, almost every talk I give is pretty controversial. So what I ask you is to sit and listen to what I have to say with an open and curious mind. Because if you walk away with just one tip to deal with women better in your department, then it's worth the next 20 minutes. So most of the stuff we're talking about today comes from two books. The first book is from Joyce Bennison. She's a professor at Emmanuel College. And she reminds us that as women, we compete just like men. And we compete for the same things. We compete for resources, for mates, and for influence. But how we compete is very different. And the first thing on how we compete is we compete by being pretty and by being nice, on our physicality and our personality. Now, as much as I would love to blame misguided men for the whole Miss Universe pageant, distorted body image, I hate to tell you, ladies, but we have been contorting and distorting and piercing and tattooing and tucking in and pushing out our bodies for the last tens of thousands of years. And we're doing that not just to find a mate, but to outdo other women. Case in point, does anybody know what the average waist size was during the corset era in the Victorian era? Anybody want to guess? 22 inches. 22 freaking inches. Are you kidding me? Now, I'd be willing to bet that the guy who's married to the woman with a 22-inch waist probably has no clue whether she's a 21-inch waist or a 23-inch waist. But chances are, the other women, she knows, probably knows. So if we can't compete in being pretty and being nice, we compete by undermining our competition, correct? Taking out a pretty little pink Magnum 22. No, we don't compete directly. In fact, it's very dangerous for it to compete directly, because if we compete directly and we get harmed, we might not be able to get pregnant, we might not be able to deliver our babies, we might not be able to raise our children. So we really avoid direct aggression. In fact, we're incredibly well-wired not to be directly aggressive. Compared to most men, most women recognize the emotions of fear and anger much more quickly. Furthermore, when we're stressed out, we probably are even better at recognizing that. We are also very good at downplaying things, at evening the sort of playing field. So when that EKG tech hands me an EKG, I may make $200,000 more than she is. But if we both talk about how both our kids are struggling in a certain class in school, by co-ruminating, co-miserating, we can bridge and even out that gap. So women rarely, especially with people they don't know very well, talk about their accomplishments. They downplay them. We are queen of co-rumination. So when we do undermine our competition, we do it indirectly, and we do it using indirect aggression. And we try to be as anonymous as possible, because we don't want to get physically hurt. We just want to put that woman in her place. And we all know what that looks like. We were all seventh grade girls. It's eye rolling. It's inferring that somebody's sleeping around. It's exaggerating a story. It's stockpiling everything you didn't like about that person for the right moment to go after them. And it's spreading false rumors. So Benson's theories is that women compete quite fiercely. It's just how we compete looks different than how men compete. We avoid physical aggression. And then the group dynamics is different. And this is really a key point. I read quite a bit, and this is something I had never heard of before, because we hear so much about this tend and befriend literature as far as oxytocin release and women being very generous with other women and comforting each other. Well, what Benson will say, let's look at that a little bit more. And she will say that men, when they're in a group, especially if that group has either a significant external goal or they're in a significant competition with another group, become fiercely loyal to the group. So you're a Clemson football player. You're in the group involved with the stock takeover. You're at war. And that those guys in that group are very tolerant about the idiosyncratic behavior of the other members of the group. Women, a little bit different. She will say that women's group identity is simply to not be excluded from the group. Because to be excluded from the group means that you might not have enough resources, that your kids might starve. So a slightly different concept of, I want to be a football player versus, I just don't want to be not a cheerleader. And one of the things I do is, last year I had a chance to do some Title IX talks, and I think this is a great example to underscore what I'm trying to get at here. Imagine you're in a college campus. Imagine a girl in a sorority has a date rape claim against a guy in a fraternity. Many times, the other guys in that fraternity will immediately sort of swoop in around that guy and say he's innocent. Many times, the girls in that sorority, however, are not going to swoop in and in uniform solidarity to support that girl. So I don't think we're going to get at the date rape culture until we get at this groupthink council with men saying it is okay to call out that guy who is a different girl in his room every Friday night. And then I also think we need to build in structures to protect the girl who comes forward, because oftentimes the women she thinks are going to support her in that endeavor never show up. So how do we compete? First, we do so incredibly discreetly by being pretty and nice. In fact, we don't do this so discreetly that sometimes we don't even know we're competing. And the example for this is, if I were to ask you to close your eyes and raise your hands and ask how many of you have been put under the bus by another woman professionally, probably many of you would raise your hands. And then if I were to do the follow-up question, how many of you have put another woman under the bus, much fewer hands would go up. So many times we don't even know we're doing this because nice and pretty girls don't do this. So we don't even want to recognize it in ourselves. Second, if we're going to be aggressive, we're going to do it usually by indirect aggression. And only as last resort will we go for a direct hit. With the exception that if you live with somebody and you're genetically related to them, such as sisters, perhaps there's some direct hits going on. And there's a little bit of a safety net because you share some DNA, so you might stop short of killing each other. But otherwise, if you see two women in a hospital setting having a direct, loud, aggressive, verbal conversation, there is a lot of pathology there. And it probably goes way, way, way beyond that particular argument. So let's look at some examples for this. If you ask second grade kids to ask who are their two best friends, and then you make design, like Venn graphs of them, all the boys will look like this huge web. They're all glumped together, because Eddie's best friends with Frank, who's best friends with Joe, who's best friends with Eddie. With girls, you don't see that. You see these little triads all over the place. The rarity of girl gangs. You just don't see them. attractiveness. Girls who are pretty in high school are much, much, much more likely to be the targets of indirect aggression than handsome boys. And finally, in polygamous relationships, direct aggression is very common amongst the two women with the same husband. And we see this in our kind of polygamous relationships in the inner city, where you have a guy who has fathered children from four or five different women. Now, the second person we're going to talk about is Ann Litwin. And she wrote a book called New Rules for Women. And what she went is around the world and did a qualitative study and said, what are the challenges with women working with other women? And she came up with these friendship rules. And she said you have to have four rules if you're a woman working with another woman. You have to be equal, you have to be loyal, you have to be listening, you have to be able to share secrets. And oh, by the way, you can't ever, ever, ever talk about these rules. Of course, this is a catch-22. Because once you are not equal, once you have different roles, once you have a doctor and a nurse, you can't follow these rules. So you either don't play the rules at all, at which point you're looked at as totally aloof, or you do, and you break them, and you're looking like you're a backstabber or a betrayer. So let's look at this in the business world. Women compared to men have much smaller networks. We have preference in working groups. In a meta-analysis, men prefer to work with men. Women actually prefer to work with men, too. And unfortunately, there's a couple of studies out there that say sponsorships, women sponsoring other women, may not be doing as good a job as men sponsoring other men as far as investing their own time and effort. And the reputation of women bosses. By a recent Gallup poll, most of us don't really care if we work for a male boss or a female boss, almost about half of us. But of the half that do care, we would much prefer to work for a male boss. Now, but what about our medical world? This was somebody's evaluation. This was a first-year OBGYN's evaluation. Needs to lose her crown. This was 8 years of female nurses evaluating first-year OBGYNs. And as you can see, the females were much harder on the female OBs than they were on the males. This is a qualitative study on internal medicine residents about code resuscitations. And the bottom line here is that the females were much more worried about not just running the code technically correct, but maintaining the relationships because they don't want to get the backlash from pissing off a nurse when they walked out the room. And then the final thing is this dearth mentality. And this is the idea that if you have 50 people in your department and 10 positions of leadership, but only two of them are women, all the women think that they're only really competing for those two and not the other 10. So the competition has increased. So how do we move forward? So my first thing is I have an ask for everybody in this room. And my ask is sometime in the next day or so, when you have a quiet moment, I want you to summon your seventh grade remnant of yourself. Because chances are your seventh grade self is the one who taught you how to master the art of indirect aggression. And when you channel her, I want you to give her a big, big hug and tell her thank you, because chances are she might actually have had some part in keeping you alive during your teenage years. But then I want you to summon her away. I want you to banish her. My ask is that you banish your seventh grade girl, because there is no place in this world that we are trying to create in this room for her influence, and there's no need for her. So I'm going to volunteer to go first. When I was seventh grade, my name was Jeannie. I was only Jeanette when I was in trouble, and then it was always Jeanette Marie Wolfe. So I'm going to summon Jeannie. I think she's getting close because I see a pair of Jordache jeans and I hear Journey on the radio. Thank you, Jeannie. Now be gone. You can take the jeans and wear some more sunscreen. Seriously, we have to start with ourselves if we want to change this. What are some other things we can do? This is right out of Ann Litwin's work. Recognize that there's a catch-22. Talk about it and agree to some new rules. And here are the new rules. We are going to talk about conflict directly, or we're going to let it go. There's not going to be any of this indirect violence anymore. Let's look at how this might play out with different power dyads. When we go to work, many times we have more power, by the traditional definition, than most of the women we work with. The first thing that we can do is we can model. We may not be able to get rid of every seventh grade girl in our department, but hopefully we can get rid of our own. The second thing we can do is acknowledge the catch-22. And that might be worded like something like this. When we go to work, we have different jobs. And I really want to support you. And I think we need to understand that sometimes our jobs are going to interact and there's going to be some conflict. And I really want to have a commitment with you so that we can provide the best patient care that we can and that we can support each other as best we can, that when conflict occurs, that we're going to deal with it directly and by trying to talk through it. The other thing we can do, which is low-lying fruit, is validate the women we work with. Say thank you to that EKG tech who brings you the old EKG with the one she wants you to sign. Play up a nurse when you're going in to see a patient. Oh my gosh, you're so lucky you have Jackie as your nurse today. You are in such good hands. That goes back to patient-centered care. It's important that the patients think we have our shit together and we support each other. I'm a big, big fan of liberal use of timeouts. We all do this with really critical situations. I would suggest you try to use it with people that you may not have the best relationship with work. And that is when you have a patient, you're talking about these in the next critical actions, trying to create the shared mental model, and then open up the space. So this is what I think needs to happen. Am I forgetting anything? Is there anything else we should be thinking about? That opens up the space to validate their own contribution back. And if you're working with dominant men, I totally suggest that they use this too, because it opens up a space for the women who are too intimidated to speak to have a voice. Now, junior faculty, the most important thing is that we simply can be available. I think we need to understand that what women need at different times of their career varies, and what you may have to offer may or may not resonate with somebody at a particular time. But keep your door open, because their life may change. We talked about this yesterday. There is so much power in asking somebody to be included. We all have so many connections that we don't even realize we have unless we sit down and think about it, that could enhance and jumpstart people's career who are a step or two behind us. I know in my own life, Mark Plaster, Kathy Klim, Tracy Sanson, Alice McGregor, people who just put out an ask. You can change young doctors' life by putting out the ask. It is very powerful. Please use it to support each other. When you are working with junior faculty, be very intentional in what your role is. Are you a cheerleader, just encouraging them to try something new? Are you a coach, trying to give them advice about how to do things better? Are you a mentor? I'm very much into skill-based mentor. Seek out a mentor and be a mentor based on a skill. And are you a sponsor? Shout out the other women in your department. How many times have you heard that somebody's published a chapter or given a lecture? Nobody else in the department even knows. When you hear about it, email it to everybody else in the department and give a good shout out. We can do so much to support other women in our department indirectly. Make sure women are on your important committees. Make sure they're in your hiring committees, in your promotional committees. Make sure that they're looking at the policies so you're not having policies going into effect that adversely affect women. And as many of you know from my writing, I'm really, really into making sure that when you're in a program committee recruiting speakers, that you actively recruit diverse speakers, because people need to see other people that look and sound just like they do. Now, what about if it's at the same level as somebody else? You're equal with somebody else. I think you need to understand that oftentimes you may be competing with that other woman for a spot in the workplace. That's the reality. You might both be going for associate program director. You might both want to be in this certain committee. And that's part of the American workplace. Again, talking about it, breaking the silence, and agreeing to align forces when you're able to in other areas. As Esther talked about yesterday, amplify. You're in a department meeting, a woman says a great idea, give them a shout out and credit. And reclaim it if somebody else tries to take credit from that woman. Bob, that's so great that you like Ann's idea. What are we gonna do to move forward with it? Use your vote. Not everybody will agree with me on this, but how many times do you get these things from the hospital that says, put 6 proxy votes on something? I now know, after I vote for the people I know, I'll look at who else is on the ballot. I know statistically from work and business that if a woman's name on the ballot, she's probably very qualified for that job. And I have no ethical problems if I don't know the last 6 people to pick 3 of the women. And seek relationships outside of your department. We all need a posse. And your posse has to have two criteria. It has to be absolutely safe. And the second thing is they have to be able to give you critical feedback. We are not going to go anywhere in our careers unless we can own the own things that we have to do to, as Tracy Sanson would say, what am I doing well? What do I need to stop? What do I need to do better? You need to have people in your circle who you are comfortable enough to be able to hear that message so that you can professionally grow. I was very lucky a few years ago to do this national fellowship program called the Impact Center. Several emergency medicine females have gone through it. It is not a medical leadership program. This is women who are high-performing women from multiple different fields. It is a great opportunity, and the reason why it's so great is twice a year we would shut the doors and we would go around the room and a woman would say, I'm dealing with this problem at work. And these women who had no skin in that individual's woman's game gave them honest, authentic, and safe advice. It was incredibly powerful. Find your own posse. Now finally, what do you do if your dyad is otherwise? You have a female chair, you have a female vice president. Understand that they may be walking their own tightropes. They may be dealing with huge issues associated with implicit bias. They also may be in their own catch-22. You need to ask yourself, how are they leading? Do you want to lead like them? You also have to ask, how are they leading, and how much is that their innate personality, and how much of it is the constraints of the institution that they're working at? Have a little bit of slack for those above us. They have a hard job, and sometimes when we just look at it in a very superficial manner, we may not appreciate that. If you are going to approach them for help, target your ask. We talked about this the other day. Go to mentoring-specific, skill-specific help. Many times, all these relationships always work better if there's something in it for the other person. If the woman is your vice chief or chair, your default is always, I want to develop this skill because I know you want the emergency department to look really awesome in this meeting. So make sure that there's something in it for them. And finally, look beyond your department. There are amazing women out in emergency medicine. There's amazing women in this room. Many times you're not going to be able to get the leadership positions that you want within your department. Look throughout your hospital, look regionally, look nationally. So here are my conclusions. Banish your seventh grade girl. Recognize the catch-22, break the silence, and agree to new rules. So this is my Twitter, and this is my news podcast, sexandwhy.com. Thank you very much.